Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we celebrate Memorial Day, that special day of the year when we honor those who have died in war, making the ultimate sacrifice for the nation. In recognition of Memorial Day, we've decided to look at the history of citizenship in the United States, guaranteed by those who have died in war, and some would argue we have taken for granted. In following that, we look at the historical justification for the latest charge against an American organization of benefiting from slavery. But before we get to those subjects, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. May 28, 1987 witnessed one of the worst embarrassments ever to occur in the Soviet government and military. 19-year-old Matthias Rust, an amateur pilot from West Germany, took off from Helsinki, Finland, and traveled through more than 400 miles of Soviet airspace before landing his small airplane in Moscow's Red Square, only a few hundred yards from the Kremlin. Apparently not harboring any political or social agenda, Rust appeared to be motivated only by a passion for flying, but his enthusiasm for flight took him deep into Soviet territory, undetected or ignored by Soviet air defense systems. While circling Red Square a few times before landing, Rust attracted the attention of curious onlookers and tourists who believed the plane was part of an air show. Upon landing, however, he was quickly arrested and tried for violating Soviet airspace. He served 18 months in prison before being released. In response to the incident, Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev sacked his Minister of Defense, and the Russian military was humiliated, but a much-needed dose of humor was injected into the sobriety of the Cold War. To many, a teenage amateur pilot in a small civilian aircraft had invaded the Soviet Union. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, at the annual Historical Clinico-Pathological Conference held at the University of Maryland, doctors have applied their skills of diagnosis to yet another figure whose death has not been satisfactorily explained by historical records. They found that King Herod, the tyrannical Judean ruler who allegedly tried to kill the infant Jesus, died of gangrene, brought on by complications from kidney disease. Several physicians speculate that Herod's kidney ailment resulted in mental illness, which may explain Herod's brutal treatment of his family and his Judean subjects. In past years, the conference concluded that rabies killed Edgar Allan Poe, and Roman Emperor Claudius died from eating poisonous mushrooms. British Admiral Horatio Nelson, who triumphed over Napoleon's naval forces at the decisive Battle of Trafalgar in 1805, only to be killed aboard ship during that epic struggle, has emerged in British history as an indelible icon. However, the recent discovery of Nelson's unpublished private love letters to his mistress, Lady Emma Hamilton, has revealed an all-too-human, passionate, and even erotic dimension of Nelson's character. Previous Victorian biographers of Nelson found details of Nelson's extramarital exploits too hot for publication. This is Talking History. When the Founding Fathers established this nation, they insisted that only good citizenship would guarantee its survival. While we have survived more than 200 years, but just how have we done as citizens? That is the subject of Fred Nielsen's conversation this week with Michael Schudson.
Although good citizenship is a civic virtue, conventional wisdom holds that Americans are increasingly bad citizens. They don't join organizations as much as they used to, they don't follow politics, fewer and fewer of them vote. According to my guest, Michael Schudson, Americans practice citizenship differently than they used to. But different is not necessarily worse. We may, in fact, be better citizens than the conventional wisdom would suggest. Schudson is a professor of communication and sociology at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of The Good Citizen, A History of American Civic Life. He was a MacArthur Fellow from 1990 to 1994. Professor Schudson, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The Founding Fathers often spoke of the people. What did they mean by that term?
When they talked about the people who they wanted to participate in the governing of the country, they were thinking about white males who owned property. It was really that limited in their conception of it.
What was the relationship of the people supposed to be, as defined by the founders, to the government? What kinds of citizens were these people expected to be?
Well, very, very, very different from what we think citizens should be today, because even for those rich white males, the founders who theorized what American government should look like thought that those citizens should be deferential to the few among them who were kind of natural-born leaders and should be elected to the legislatures, to the Congress, and the rest of the citizens, the voters, the white male voters, should pretty much elect people of good character and then let them do their business and check in on them again in a couple years.
Did voting matter very much, or was it simply a matter of consent, or, as you put it, assent to natural leaders?
In most cases, in the early years, in the 18th century, even into the beginnings of the 19th century, it was a matter of knowing who the men of social status and standing and in the community were, and really letting them do the job. There weren't issues in campaigns. There weren't platforms. It was the way you might elect a team captain on a baseball team. No one has to make a campaign speech for that position. It's just a matter of knowing who's a generally a good player and a person of judgment.
Now, by the 19th century, Americans certainly have issues, slavery paramount among them. For many Americans these days, the high point of American political discourse and campaigning is the Lincoln-Douglas debates, where Lincoln and Douglas, campaigning for the Senate in 1858, argued over slavery. And yet you suggest that these debates between Lincoln and Douglas don't necessarily prove what people often think they prove, that politics was more thoughtful or virtuous back in the 1850s.
That's right. I mean, the debates, if you read them now, do have some wonderful, absolutely wonderful elements in them, although those elements get repeated over and over again, and there are some things we like to forget about where there's real name-calling between Lincoln and Douglas, you know, spreading rumors about each other that weren't true. I don't want to denigrate the quality of their speech. What attracted me to rethink this is simply remembering, as we tend to forget, that no one who went out to hear them voted for either of them, for the simple reason that the Senate was not directly popularly elected until early in the 20th century. So people voted for the state legislatures, and the state legislature ultimately elected Douglas senator in 1858. So the people who went out to hear the debates did so not to make up their minds about which candidate to vote for. They went there to cheer for the home team. So the Republicans cheered for Lincoln and yelled and shouted epithets at Douglas and vice versa. It was a great event in people's lives. It was a celebration. It was a festival. It was a carnival. It was a wonderful day's outing, but it wasn't calm, rational political discourse.
The Founding Fathers didn't want political parties at all, and yet we finally got them. For much of the 19th century, indeed, as you point out, party affiliation was the primary thing that shaped politics and citizenship in the United States.
That's right. For much of the 19th century, and this is a real contrast to what the Founding Fathers had experience, but for the 19th century, political parties really owned American politics, and affiliating with a political party was a very important act for men. It's still only the men voting at that time. What affiliation with a party meant was connecting with a team, like connecting with your high school against the other high school's basketball team. I don't want to demean it entirely. It wasn't purely an act of emotion. There, different parties did represent somewhat different views, but their main interest, ordinarily in the 19th century, was in winning, and winning in order to gain the spoils of office and put supporters and their cousins and their sisters and their aunts into office as well. That's for large swaths of the 19th century, there was not much difference or not much one could tell ideologically between the parties. And when there were important issues like slavery, up until the 1850s and the advent of the Republican Party, the leading parties simply tried to avoid it.
You observe that the question of who votes can't be separated in the end from the question of what voting means. What did voting mean in the 19th century?
It meant fraternity. It meant going out and showing that you were a member of your lodge hall. It was it was a politics of affiliation, of social solidarity. And to give you an example, when people actually went to the polls throughout much of the 19th century, the state didn't print the ballots, the parties printed the ballots, and the parties distributed the ballots. There would be someone at the polling place from each party known as a ticket peddler, and you went over to the ticket peddler from your party, you took the ticket that he handed you, and you didn't even have to look at it. You didn't have to mark it. It already had the names of, say, the Democrats, and you put it in the ballot box. So you can see that even symbolically, the central act of political life, voting, was a social relationship with another member of the party, much more than it was a civic or citizenly connection to the state or the polity as a whole.
We take it for granted these days that voting should be done in secret. We go to a public place, but we close the curtain behind us when we actually vote and assume that no one should know how we cast our ballot. And yet it's striking that for most of American history, voting was done openly. What was the justification for that?
Well, I don't think there really was much of a justification. People just took it for granted. When proponents of a secret ballot came along, there were some defenses. John Stuart Mill in England made a spirited defense of open voting. He thought if people voted in secret, they would be voting less responsibly because they wouldn't have to own up to how they were voting. But the people really just took it for granted that voting was a public and social act.
How and when does the secret ballot finally get adopted?
Well, I think surprisingly to most people, it certainly doesn't go back to the founding fathers. The secret ballot came in for the first time in the late 1880s. 1892, a majority of states had adopted the secret ballot, and by 1896, almost all of them had. So the secret ballot is a little more than 100 years old, and the idea of it was as an anti-party reform. As I've just explained, that the parties really controlled everything down to the printing of the ballot. And there was increasingly in the early progressive era a feeling among reformers that the parties were standing between the citizen and his government and corrupting the process. The secret ballot was one of a series of measures, including civil service reform, and other reforms that tried to take power away from the parties and put it in the hands of individual citizens.
Another reform of the same era, approximately a century ago, redefined citizenship in terms of an informed public. You didn't want people voting who didn't know what they were voting for, who didn't understand the issues. This helps detach individuals from parties, as you've said, but it also leads to the requirement that people know how to read, the establishment of literacy tests, for example, which has the practical effect of disfranchising not only black Americans, but even many whites. They lose their right to vote.
That's right. And the reforms of this era, though we've stayed with most of them and taken them to heart, and the idea of the informed citizen that really is born in this era of 1890 to 1920. But it's a from our present perspective, it's a very mixed reform. The effort to give more power to individuals, remove some power from the self-serving parties, that part we still see as it was called then, progressive. But some of the progressives were decidedly racist and wanted to take hands out of the parties, in part because the parties were enrolling the freed blacks in voting, and the parties were enrolling immigrants in the cities in voting. And it's not a secret that some of the reformers quite intentionally wanted to make the reforms in part to keep some of these people from voting.
What's the model of citizenship in America today?
Well, I think this progressive era model of the informed citizen is the one that is on the tips of our tongues today, the one we most routinely come to and think about as the model of citizenship. I myself don't think that's quite right. We've had these other models of citizenship, the deferential citizen of the 18th century, the partisan citizen of the 19th century, and really from the civil rights movement on, another model of citizenship that emphasizes not that we should be informed about all the issues of the day, but that we should be particularly well informed about our own rights and be willing and able to defend them in public places. I'd like to think that we can draw on the resources of all four of those models in the present day, and I think we need to rethink and, in a way, unthink some of the dangers of the informed citizen model.
As we began, there are so many people worrying these days about how poor our civic life is. We've become bad citizens. That, of course, implies a comparison with previous eras, a comparison that is at least implicit throughout much of your book. What is the status of our civic life these days? Are we, in fact, bad citizens?
Well, I'm very resistant to notions like the Tom Brokaw notion that there was a greatest generation. Different generations have different challenges, and different generations have different experiences. And the task for us today is to find our own path to citizenship. I mean, if we had, I don't wish on us a depression and a world war. That's what forged the so-called greatest generation. We're a different group, those of us living at the dawn of the 21st century. We have to find a way of citizenship where rights are more important than they were in the 1930s or the 1830s, where women as well as men are fully empowered citizens, where we've made some real progress in creating a legitimately diverse society, but those that progress has costs and challenges, and we have to find new modes of citizenship. I think we're doing just that. I mean, people are citizens in their own homes these days, where public norms of equality and equal respect between parents and children and husbands and wives and are rich and fully embodied in ways that you just can't find in earlier eras. So I think it's a matter of where you look for citizenship and how you define it. I think we've arrived at a point where citizenship is much more expansive, is practiced in many more aspects of life than was probably ever true before. Does that mean we do it well? Are we good citizens in that sense? Well, that's something we're still working at.
Well, that sounds more hopeful than the usual news, I must say.
I feel more hopeful.
Thank you, Professor Schudson.
It's a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Michael Schudson, the author of The Good Citizen, A History of American Civic Life.
Was created in the years immediately following the Civil War, originally intended to commemorate those who died in that war. So for our site of the week, we've decided to focus on the Civil War and tell you about a guide to those sites associated with one of its best-known generals. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
It's one thing to know about the Civil War sites that are affiliated with Stonewall Jackson, but what about the other places, places that helped shape his life? Thanks to a guidebook written by Clint Johnson, In the Footsteps of Stonewall Jackson, you can see the places that he saw during his life. The book tracks Jackson from his birth in Clarksburg, West Virginia, to his student days at West Point and his early posting at Fort Hamilton in what is now Brooklyn, and the house outside of Fredericksburg, Virginia, where he died during the war. And don't worry, if you can't make it to see the sites, the book is a wonderful armchair tour of the sites as well.
The list of companies and other organizations charged with benefiting from slavery grows longer every day. One of the latest is Yale University, and as law professor Alfred Brophy tells us, Yale is not alone in profiting from slavery.
In the midst of Yale University's 300th anniversary, three graduate students have brought to light Yale's involvement with holding and trading slaves. Men who profited from slavery contributed to the university and were honored by it. In the 1930s, Yale named one of its colleges after the most notorious pro-slavery politician of them all, John C. Calhoun. Yale is not alone here. Profits from the harsh slave plantations of the Caribbean funded Harvard Law School's first endowed chair. Slaves worked on the Princeton campus when slavery was legal in the North. Why does that matter? Many think a university taking money made from slavery and honoring slaveholders is irrelevant. They say, we don't believe in slavery now, and back then people had different values. But slavery actually was condemned by some intellectual leaders in early America. In the 1680s, shortly after the settlement of Pennsylvania, a few Quakers made the first efforts to discourage slavery. Those protests gathered strength. In the wake of the American Revolution, many people, inspired by Enlightenment ideas that taught the fundamental equality of humans, urged the abolition of slavery. In the 1850s, Harriet Beecher Stowe, author of the best-selling novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, reached the hearts of Americans. Many readers wanted to take action against slavery, but they found it difficult to break free from the constraints of their community, for many churches, political parties, and laws tacitly supported slavery. Stowe pessimistically concluded that, from the great institutions in society, no help whatever is to be expected. Had there been more support from the great bastions of moral power, like Yale, there might have been change. Instead, while Ralph Waldo Emerson was telling students to reject outmoded ideas, like slavery, orators at Yale ridiculed him. In the wake of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which required Northerners to return fugitive slaves to their Southern owners, orators at Yale, Harvard, and Brown argued fiercely in favor of the act. There are some lessons in this for us. It reminds us that at many times universities are the product and beneficiary of the powerful and affluent interests, in this case what used to be called the slave power. And so universities are more often likely to justify than condemn those interests. Those who say, do not condemn a school for decisions that were acceptable at the time, are just others in a long line of thinkers stretching back to the pro-slavery advocates of the 1800s who believe, with Alexander Pope, that whatever is right. Maybe we can learn from Yale's complicity in slavery. Perhaps we can remember Emerson's lesson that it is the duty of the scholar to rethink old ideas and be the bringer of hope, and it is the job of the universities to lead the way.
You've been listening to University of Alabama professor Alfred Brophy, author of Reconstructing the Dreamland, the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation. Brophy's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History.
This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
And finally, we have three interesting programs to call to your attention, which will air soon on the History Channel. The Manhattan Project premieres on June 4th. In the early morning hours of July 16, 1945, scientists and dignitaries awaited the detonation of the first atomic bomb in a desolate area of the New Mexican desert, aptly known as Yomada de Muerto, Journey of Death. Dubbed the Manhattan Project, the federal government tackled the top-secret undertaking with unprecedented speed and expense, almost $30 billion in today's dollars. In the documentary, Los Alamos scientists and engineers relate their trials, triumphs, and dark doubts about building the ultimate weapon of war in the interest of peace. On June 7th, toured the catacombs of Rome in a program of the same title. Descend into the tunnels dug beneath ancient Rome, a labyrinth of beautifully decorated burial chambers and vaults where religious outcasts, pagans, Jews, and Christians secretly preserved their forbidden rituals. And on June 10th, look for Punishment, where historians explore the history of criminal punishment. From execution by wild animals during the ancient Greek and Roman times, to religious torture during the Inquisition, to death by firing squad, hanging, and lethal injection, all in the name of justice and creating a more humane society. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.